Good evening, and welcome to the December 5th, 2016 meeting of the Astoria City Council. Glad to see such a great group of people here tonight. We're glad to have you here. Chief Johnston.
Councilor Nemelo.
Here.
Councilor Warren.
Here.
Councilor Bryce.
Here.
Mayor Lemire.
Here.
And Mayor, if I might say that Chief Ames is not here this evening. He is in the middle of starting tonight's food parade, which begins in East Astoria through the Alderbrook and Emerald Heights and Uppertown neighborhoods. And the food parade will be continuing in the central neighborhoods tomorrow night and then over in the western neighborhoods and South Slope on Wednesday night. So hoping those who live around those routes and want to participate, you know, please give your donations of canned goods.
Great. Thank you. Reports of councilors. Councilor Warr.
Just one little thing. I've got a box of canned goods on my front porch for the thing tonight, and there's no way in the world my wife can lift it, so I hope they'll run up and grab it.
I'm sure they will.
I'll try to catch the flu from the fire chief. How about that?
Okay. Yeah. Councilor Price.
I think I'll pass tonight. Thanks.
Okay. Councilor Nimmowell?
I don't have a report, but my family looks forward to the fire department's food parade every year. It's really become a big Christmas tradition for us, so hats off to the fire department.
Okay. I met with the new Liberty Theater director, Jennifer Crockett, and a nice gal. She's also a musician. I think this is a great new addition to the city. There have been a lot of changes in our city recently, if you haven't noticed. And this is we're delighted that Jennifer has joined us, and I think she'll be a great addition. The other thing, I will be in the food parade tomorrow night, so if you're in the central city, wave to me, please. And we'll be picking up your food donations. So glad that's going on. Any changes to the agenda?
Mayor, did you want to?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Tonight, we have the world famous Astoria football team. This is a great team, and I want to mention some of them that were awarded particular honors, and then those, and also those who are here, because I think that's great. Astoria senior Ficha Frimstead was named Offensive Player of the Year for the Coapa League. Samboy Tuamato, who is here, was one of three defensive players of the year, and Howard Rube was named co-coach of the year this week. So let's give those folks a hand first. And then I'm going to mention some of the others, the other honors, because there were a lot. The Coapa All-League had a league-high 14 selections from Astoria High School. And those include Offensive Player of the Year, Ficha Frimstead, which I've already mentioned, and Samboy Tuamato as the Defensive Player of the Year, Coach of the Year, Howard Rube, but also wide receiver Olaf England, Ryan Palick, guard Matthew Mather, tight end Keldon Littell. Is that right? Is that close?
Tackle.
Okay. Jeez, I thought a T stood. Okay. Okay. Tackle Isaac Villa. Andrew Showerman, who is the kicker, I understand. Keldon Littell again. Tyler Lingstad, Samboy Tuamoto. A lot of these names are repeated several times, so that's really great. Center, Jared LeCour, wide receiver, Kyle Strange. So I think some of those folks are here tonight, and I'm delighted that they're here. And do we have a... I think we have something for them, don't we? Okay.
You're
okay.
More than enough.
Okay, all right. Well, we're delighted. And Howard, join them, please, and stand up, Howard, because as the co-coach of the Willapa, Kawapa, that just does me in, Kawapa League, and all these folks here, we're really proud of you. I went to the last game, and I have season tickets to the game, so I am a real fan, and I am proud of all of you. And I know the city is too. So congratulations. Yeah, I think Julie was going to prepare something, but anyway, okay. Okay, so let's see. Changes to the agenda.
So I would like to make one change to the agenda. That would be to add another agenda item under the regular agenda. That's an item C entitled Aquatics Center and Recreation Center Holiday New Year Promotion. And that will be under the regular agenda section. It'll be a 7C.
Okay. Oh, 7C. Okay, and next we have a presentation then from the Astoria School District Strategic Plan.
Thank you for allowing us to
And
have
Mr.
a short...
Hoppus, if you will give your name.
I'm not
and
used
your...
to doing Paul. I'm used to sitting on that side. So. My name is Craig Hoppus. I'm the superintendent of schools in Astoria.
And your address.
111 McClure, Astoria.
Thank you.
So... I also want to introduce David Ozer, who's a regular at your board meetings. He's also a school board member of ours. So I had sent you a pretty extensive PowerPoint, but I'm going to skip a lot of it after I find out that more specific to what the city does. One of the reasons we're doing this is we're going out to a lot of different entities, and the school is a part of our community and a very important part of our community, just like the city is. And we just want to get sort of the word out on some of the work we're doing. Thank the city for some of the partnerships that we have and just describe sort of what we're doing. So we started this process about 2 years ago with a strategic plan that talked about providing direction for the school district. We had a lot of things going, but we didn't really have a focus, nor did we have priorities. So we spent probably 2 years ago, probably 35 to 40 meetings, staff, community meetings, and looking at what was important to our community and really create a strategic plan about it. What you have in front of you is the mission, vision, and then there's 7 core beliefs with some focus areas on the other side. So I'm just going to go over one of the, I'll answer any questions you want on the core beliefs. So I'm just going to go over one of the core beliefs, but I'll talk a little bit about the mission statement that was created through this 35, 40 meetings we had, and that mission statement is sort of our core belief of what we exist in. Oops, went too far. And what we're doing is prepare each student and, to his or her fullest potential for a life of learning, citizenship, and work. And some key things in there around citizenship. We want them to be productive members of our own community and productive members of society. So our vision statement, if you notice our vision statement, I won't read it because people can read it on their own, but community is mentioned twice in our vision statement because, again, we think it's important that our students be members of the community and part of the community. We also created, based on that, 7 core beliefs with the understanding that with these 7 core beliefs, if we're successful at these 7 core beliefs, then we feel that we're making progress on our strategic plan. I'm only going to go over one of these, but there's 7 total. But and I can go over just a few. Like every student can learn, Each one of these has a plan in place for it. And the one that I'll bring up tonight is that all students, I think he's moving on its own. All students, staff, and families and community members are essential partners in our educational community, and we strongly believe that. We are, this is an area in our school district that we are really working to improve, is to engage our community, engage families in our school system. For instance, each of our schools is required this year to have 3 family engagement type activities for families and students to do, to work together on. We're also looking at community partners. I mean, tomorrow I'm going to the Lions Club, later on we're going to Rotary. We have mentor opportunities for all citizens. We want to involve ourselves in the business industry. We're working on some programs around vocational type education to make sure that, and we're working with the college to make sure that we are meeting the needs within our own community and making that connection within our community. So this one is a very important piece. We've done other things, like all of our literature that goes out of our school district now goes out in English and in Spanish. We have a large population of Spanish students, Hispanic students in our district. So this is just one of our, it's a key one. I know the board talk a lot about this. Do you want to add anything else to that?
No.
Okay, sorry. Okay. So there's 3 or 4 other ones. We talk about parents and families and community partnerships, and those are important. Today I met with a group of local businesses and talked about skills that they wanted in their workers and those type of things, and things that we can work within our strategic plan to get to our kids. Based on, like I stated, we have seven core areas, but really we have 3 focus areas, and I just want to mention them real quick. And one is we have an achievement gap problem in our district, and it's the same problem we have all over the state. People need to understand in our school district that half the kids who come to our schools live in poverty, over half, about 51-52%. And that's a big deal, because those kids don't have access like other kids do. So we are working really hard to help our students who live in poverty. We run 3 bus routes a day. Most districts run 2. We run one in the morning, one right after school, and then we run another one about 5:30 to 6 o'clock at night, because we have kids who are engaged in activities, not only athletics, but academic activities after school. So we run what we call an activity bus that runs kids home about 6 o'clock at night, every night, Monday through Friday, because we want to provide access for our kids to gain after school activities plus academics. Our achievement gap I talked about are kids who live in poverty, our Hispanic students, and our special ed students. We know when kids come to kindergarten that some of them are already behind before they even start kindergarten. And so we're working on different areas to work on that, and that has to do with achievement gap. The other areas I talked a little bit about is about around the word and the concept of equity. Especially if we're dealing with kids in poverty, not all kids have the same opportunity. So it's our responsibility as a district to break down barriers. One of the barriers is transportation. You know, we provide transportation for kids. We send 70-80 kids to the college every day. We provide that transportation. And our third area is we're just looking at different programs within our district and evaluating the different programs. One of our biggest ones right now that I've been working quite a bit on is mental health services. We probably have close to 15-20% of our students who need mental health services in our district. So we're working on that, and there's a number of other programs that we're going to evaluate. As from the city, we're doing this presentation in a lot of different places. We've always appreciated the partnerships we've had with the city. You know, for years, the city uses our gyms. We use the city's fields. We've had a real good partnership that way. We also have, you know, at Gray School, we have, it's really a pre-K building with an alternative ed. We have the port-a-play there. We're working closely with the port-a-play staff on some training and things that we're doing with our staff that they can join in on. So we have other partnerships that, you know, obviously the sports complex is another one, but we're always looking, whether it's the city or industry, other governmental agencies, always looking for partnerships and anything that we can do to help our kids to grow and to learn and to engage them in their education and engage them in the community. So I gave you a shorter version of it because I didn't want to get into all the other, you know, the 22 slides, but I'm willing, more than willing, to take questions.
Any questions from the council?
You have anything else?
I just, yeah, David Ozer, 254 West Irving here. I just want to really underline what Superintendent Hoppe said, that it's all about working together, networking, making connections, finding ways to bring all of our resources together, because it is a fact that you cannot have a strong, vibrant, resilient community without strong, vibrant, and resilient schools. We're all in this together, and any opportunities that we can find to work together, to be creative together, really are essential for the health of our community. And the last thing I want to do, I want to just thank Councilor Ward, who was on the school board for a dozen years and helped many years ago pass an essential referendum that is still being, the benefits of which are still being felt in our school district.
Well, Mr. Ozer, I had the pleasure many years ago of being on the school board and on the hiring committee that gave this guy his job.
Thank you.
What's that been, 27 years?
It's been here 20 years.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Hoppe. I think from time to time we all are talking or talk about ways that we can help with the students here in Astoria, and you're doing a terrific job, and you just gave me about 7 different possibilities, so thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hoppe, I've got 2 children in your school district right now. As of next fall, it will be 3, and we are tremendously happy with the schools. So nice work. Thank you for sharing your strategic plan and vision with us tonight.
And thank you, too, for me. I was 21 years in education, so I'm delighted to see all the vision statement and the various focus areas and so forth. I know that all over the country we're trying to figure out how to improve our graduation rates, and I'm delighted with all the efforts that you have been making, because I know that it's hard work. And we have to try a lot of different things to figure out what's going to work, but really appreciate all your efforts.
And like Dave said, and partnerships is a key to it.
Yeah.
You know, just last week I have in the crowd, we have a new Juntos program with the college and the Lower Columbia Hispanic Council, where we're going to work with probably about 20 to 25 families within our home county on working with getting some of our Hispanic kids.
Great.
Higher ed, so
good.
It's always about partnerships. So.
Well, thank you for all your efforts.
You bet. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks, Craig.
Thank you. Okay, and then we have a presentation on the sanctuary cities. I'm sure a lot of you have read about these in the paper. Portland is a sanctuary city, I believe Seattle is. Our chief of police is going to talk about sanctuary cities tonight.
Madam Mayor and City Council, it's with quite a bit of concern that I speak tonight. It's not usual that I am this worried about the impact of my words will be. But the issue you've asked me to address tonight is highly emotional. And I'm a little bit worried that my attempt to speak on the issue will be seen offensive on all sides of the issue, which probably means I'm in the middle and is probably a good place to be, I guess. I hope that my words can be heard for what they are. Concerned that action we take be informed, effective, and not create ambiguity that's worse than what we currently have. You'll not hear a recommendation from me tonight. This is not a decision this is a decision that I think is mostly political, and not something for staff to advocate on, but for staff to inform. You'll also hear no concern about funding. I'm all for doing the right thing first, and I think that frequently doing the right thing first takes care of the cost discussion. But over the last few weeks, I've had several conversations on the issue of Astoria becoming a sanctuary city. And I've got real mixed feelings on the matter. I understand the feeling of unrest, uncertainty, and fear that exists within certain portions of our community. It's palpable. The feelings are felt not only by those in our community who are part of a racial minority, but to a large portion of our country that feels marginalized and fearful about what the future holds. Unfortunately, those that are most affected by the sense of marginalization are some of those in our community who have the least power to affect change as well. There's a great desire for people to do something. And I'm somewhat worried that this could lead to the creation of something that has no meaning. Because what is a sanctuary city? Well, I gave you a report from the Congressional Research Service from 2015 that talks about that issue. And the conclusion they came to is there's no legal definition for sanctuary city. Instead, it's really kind of a large label for a group of cities that have formal or informal policies limiting cooperation with federal immigration authorities. And to a large part, Oregon has done that with the passage of legislation which prevents public resources from being used for the enforcement of immigration issues. The Ashland police chief was recently featured in the Oregonian for saying that Oregon's a sanctuary state. And I think he's probably on target. In fact, when you look at the Congressional Research Service's report describing sanctuary cities between the restrictions in state law and restrictions in APD policy, we comply with most of the restrictions imposed by most sanctuary city policies. State law and APD policy, for instance, do not allow us to use immigration status as a reason for a stop. Nor are we allowed to inquire as to immigration status except as it relates to the elements of a crime. Example I could think of is the possession of a forged passport. We would be allowed to inquire about that immigration status at that point while investigating the forgery crime. And that's really about it. But then some people are going to ask, so what's the harm of passing something that doesn't really mean anything? Well, what I worry about is creating a concept of a sanctuary city and creating a false sense of security. It creates the impression that within the boundaries of Astoria, the concept of sanctuary would apply. We will look at the definition of sanctuary. It's a place where someone or something's protected or given shelter, or the protection that's provided by a safe place. And neither of those meanings is within the city's power to give on issues of immigration. Several federal agencies are located in Astoria, and I just don't think we have a reality of creating a sense of sanctuary within Astoria. ICE, the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, regularly conducts surveillance, does worksite visits, and waits for people outside courtrooms in our town. And I worry that we'd be judged on the expectation of being a sanctuary and not the reality that we could actually provide such service. But I'm also really glad that immigration's not a local issue. As a police department, we spend no time enforcing immigration issues. In fact, we have no authority to enforce immigration issues or any other federal crime. And I can't imagine a scenario where the work we do could coexist with work enforcing immigration laws. Because I think of a mother came home to find her 10-year-old daughter being sodomized. The mother spoke no English and needed the daughter to interpret for her. Despite that, she felt safe coming to Astoria PD for help. And I wonder if we were in charge of enforcing immigration laws, if that would be true. That separation of enforcement powers is helpful for us. We can protect those that are within our boundaries regardless of their immigration status. If council determines that it wishes to pass a resolution declaring Astoria as a sanctuary city, what I would ask is that you take care to provide specific language in a resolution that shows what council's specific policy determinations are. Because it would be harmful to my department if there was vague language that as a result created inadvertently an impression either in the community or my department that council was asking us to violate or ignore the law. And I don't think you'd do that but I think people could perceive something vague as being that. All of our police officers are sworn to uphold the Constitution, the laws of the United States, and the state of Oregon. Any guidance that's perceived as contrary to that's dangerous as a message to them. Astoria PD is committed to respecting the rights of every person in our community, no matter their perceived power in the community. We've demonstrated several times in my career that we are willing to hold anybody in our community accountable, regardless of their status. Our oath that we take as part of the Law Enforcement Code of Ethics say that we will protect the weak against oppression and respect the constitutional rights of all. We take those responsibilities to heart. Our dedication to those principles is one of the reasons that I am so proud to lead this department. I hope that commitment to the rights of all can be seen first through all of this, and that the singular issue of Sanctuary City never defines our relationships. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you have about the matter.
Isn't a declaration by us of being a sanctuary city, or specifically to refuse to cooperate with federal law, isn't that illegal on our part?
I would ask the city attorney to answer that question.
Well, the term sanctuary city doesn't mean anything, really. It's kind of an unfortunate term. The city itself has no role in enforcing immigration laws, but in certain sense situations where a federal agent issues a directive to a city employee to perform certain acts, they do have authority to do that. In general, the police, the city council, and city employees don't get involved in any way in immigration enforcement or enforcement of any federal laws and that stuff. So, as long as what the resolution says, most what are called sanctuary cities resolutions deal with the limitation on the use of city funds to enforce immigration laws, something that doesn't happen anyway. The term, I think, started about 1992 down in Los Angeles when the Los Angeles Police Department developed a policy not to inquire as the immigration status of arrestees. And opponents of that policy came up with the term sanctuary city to refer to that internal policy of the Los Angeles Police Department. And the term's kind of gotten adopted by proponents of that policy. And so every city actually that is called a sanctuary city gets that term in a different sort of way, but from what I can tell, none of them advocate or propose to violate any federal law. Rather, what they propose to do is to limit the use of municipal resources towards the enforcement of any sort of immigration policies. So no, in that, there is no crime in that.
The one exception that I saw in the Congressional Research Service's report was those cities that have directed their subunits to actually not share information with federal authorities on things. And I think in that case, we'd be in violation of Oregon public records law, but not necessarily the federal law.
Hard to know what not share means. As I understand, federal authorities make their own investigation of public records, something that they have access to under Oregon law. But it's not as if the Astoria Police Department or any employee at the city of Astoria transfers that information to federal authorities.
Thank you, Chief. I spent some time over the past few weeks looking at the statute, the state statute. You sent me the APD's policy on immigration law enforcement. And I also looked at Chicago, San Francisco, New Haven, and Portland. All four cities have kind of gotten a lot of press for declaring that they're sanctuary cities. But then when I looked at their statutes or ordinances, they were pretty much exactly the same language that is either in our state statute, the Oregon statute, or APD's policy, or some combination. So I have been at a loss to know what the city could do in addition to what is already on the books, other than just saying that we affirm those laws and we intend to abide by them. No one's given me a resolution that would say anything differently.
Anybody else from the council? Okay, what I would say is that I think you've explained it very, very well, that perhaps being a sanctuary city is just kind of a window dressing. But I think that the APD is doing exactly what we would hope they would do. They're not looking at immigration status when they make arrests. That is not a reason for making an arrest. And I think all of us on the council would express that we are supportive of our Hispanic community. We don't want to see them unfairly targeted. And I don't believe that's happening in our city, and I'm grateful for that. And we support your actions. Anyone else? But thank you for your report. And did you want...
I don't know your format.
Sure. Go ahead. If you'll come up, though, and speak into the...
It's just a quick question.
Sure. And speak into the microphone and give your address, if you will.
My name is Kathy Cruikshank, okay. And I live at 1025 Franklin Avenue, so I'm Tuesday on the can drive. What my question was is, it's clear that someone isn't stopped for a suspicion of immigration status or whatever, but is it true that once a person is stopped for another offense or possible offense, will the police inquire of their immigration status at that time? Or is that also not a place that you would go in your procedure?
We have no reason to inquire about immigration status. It is not a violation of state law, and we can't enforce the federal law.
Okay.
Possibly the exception to that would be the person who's under arrest, we have an obligation to notify or provide them of certain warnings related to their right to a counselor, like from the embassy.
Oh.
And so there are some reasons there. But that would only be for the person that's arrested and lodged in the jail, not for a person stopped and contacted on the street.
And the person that's lodged in the jail would be saying they were a citizen of Mexico, for example, and wanting to talk to the consul?
There's an affirmative, because of treaties, there's an affirmative obligation to provide that to people who are citizens of other countries.
Okay.
So I believe we do not inquire on that, but I believe the jail does inquire as to citizenship for that purpose.
And Chief, if you would, you're talking about the county jail, is that correct?
Yes, we're talking about the county jail.
So at the point of coming into the county jail, I'm going to be asked if I'm a citizen of the United States, likely?
Not by Astoria PD.
No, I understand.
I cannot tell you all of
Yeah, of course.
The workings of the county jail.
Right, okay. That answers my question. Thank you.
Mr. McCartan.
Suppose we George McCartan, 490 Franklin Avenue, Astoria. Chief, I think this may be premature, but I think a number of us are anticipating more than just you having to stop perhaps some immigrants, whether Hispanic or otherwise, and doing, as you say, restraining and not inquiring as to their status. My question is simply this. We are in the midst of a change of federal administrations. We are in the midst of someone who has said and proclaimed and campaigned on the understanding that his administration would deport within a very short time at least 3 million illegal persons from Mexico. Assuming for the sake of argument that that goes forward, if you were called upon, and assuming also that immigration and naturalization do not have sufficient people to enforce that and get people on the buses and send them back, if immigration, if INS called upon you to assist in picking up persons undocumented, under those circumstances, what would be your response?
I believe I'd be prohibited by state law from taking that action.
Fine, thank you.
Anyone else want to speak to this issue? I know it's a very important issue and a very emotional issue, and particularly for the Hispanic community. So I don't know whether I see a couple from the Hispanic community back there. Do you want to say anything or not? Nope. Okay. All right. Well, thank you. I really appreciate your report. And as I say, I think we're all, well, I can't say we're all, but I will say I am opposed to bullying. I am opposed to racism. I am opposed to anything that would damage our friends from other countries.
Amen.
So, yeah. So thank you. Okay. Do we have another?
No other presentation.
Okay. Our consent calendar is considered routine, and it'll be adopted by one motion. Unless a member of the City Council or someone from the public has requested that an item be removed. Has anyone from the community asked for an item to be removed?
There have been no requests from the community, but I have received notice that Councillor Price would like to remove item 6B and 6F from the consent agenda.
Okay. Anyone else from the council wish to remove an item? Okay, could we have a motion then to remove, to approve item 6A, C, D, and E?
So moved.
Second.
Let's see. Ms. Cosby, roll call.
Councilor Nemelo?
Aye.
Councilor Ward?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Mayor Lemire?
Aye. Thank you. Okay, outfitting of police vehicle. This is item 6B.
So this is an agenda item that would move forward with the outfitting of communication materials in a police vehicle, which council is authorized for purchase at your November 7th, 2016 meeting. And staff has received a quote after soliciting for through three vendors. And the quote from Wireworks Incorporated in the amount of $13,696.86 was received. Tonight it's recommended that council approve that expenditure for the setup of the police vehicle.
Okay, Councilor Price.
Thank you, Madam Mayor. I have no quarrel with the cost of it or anything. I just wanted to pass along publicly a request that I hear frequently, which is whenever possible to make the police vehicles more visible to the public and more friendly. And the chief and I had a little conversation about this earlier today. I don't know if you want, there's a really interesting history behind why it's so subtle, the lettering is subtle, but I just wanted to pass it along.
Maybe Chief, if you could provide a little bit of background in terms of how we got to the design we have.
So several years ago, we, previous police chief Pete Curzon very much wanted to restore our vehicles to a black and white theme, and I was supportive of that, and internally the department was not supportive of it. So as a help to Pete, I said, let's go public and do a public survey, show the public the designs we've come up with. Surely they'll support the black and white designs that we've come up with. And we did a survey, we published it on our Facebook page, and what we found was that overwhelmingly they hated our designs of the black and whites. And that most of the comments that we got were to use some a color other than white, something that contrasted but not as stark as the black and white. So that's what we did. We went and we found a color. When we shopped the current design, it was a little lighter when we were showing it, and then when we got the actual products, that the vinyl that they put on the sides of the cars, it was darker than we wanted. If you look at the progression of our vehicles from about 2013 to now, you'll actually see there's a variation, and the two newest cars are a little lighter than the two earliest cars. So the gray is getting a little lighter as time goes on. What we actually wanted to do with the design was to make it retro-reflective, so that during the day it was gray and at night it was bright white. And what we found was all the products that were out there that allowed us to do that actually were more brown than gray in the tone, just as a result of the technique they used to do that feature. And it looked horrible against the black. So we opted to not do the retro-reflective. And that's where we are.
Yeah, it seems like they've been that design for a lot longer than 3 years.
There's a saying, a rumor, I guess, that police chiefs like to change uniforms in police cars. And once they've done that, they know their job is done.
Okay, well, I won't push it, but I just wanted to say that it seems to me they've been that way for a long time, and I know that when I was younger and men noticed me more, I would never have stopped for one of these cars because it's just too unmarked. And in down south when I was again younger, happened frequently to younger women. That you would have these cars that would kind of look like cop cars, maybe have a sign on it, and it would turn out to be false. So now I've lived here a long time. I know all most of the cops a little bit, and I know that they're really swell people, and they're not like stealth guys and gals, but that's kind of the way it looks from the outside. And I do still hear from younger women saying, I would never stop for one of those things except maybe at the mini mart or something in a real public place. They're kind of unnerving. So anyway.
The two comments I'd have to that is, one, state law allows that to drive if you feel unsafe, to drive to a place that is safe. And the second thing is, from the front end, our police cars look every bit like a police car as anybody else's police car. We spend a great deal of time ensuring that the lighting to the front and back of our police cars is very, very good. And I would think you would find it be hard-pressed to separate ours from the most marked of police cars.
Okay. Thank you. I move that we approve item 6B.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Okay. And the second item, Commissioner Price.
Okay. And again, this is... Well, actually, this is more, I think, my own interest, although I suspect some others share it as well, on the landscaping of new parking lots or ones that are redone. I'm hoping that in the future, not tonight, but I wonder if at some point we could consider an amendment to our development code that would require larger size container plants and larger caliper trees to help hide parking lots, particularly when they're on the 30 on the entrances and exits to the city. because we're getting a lot of hardscape and a lot of parking lots, and this one looks certainly a lot better than it did. This is the lot where just east of the hospital where there was an old auto thing that's been torn down, and there are some street improvements that go along with that, and I just think that in future we could use a little more greenery.
Yeah, and Mayor, if I may,
sure.
Councilor Price and I talked about this issue earlier. Over the past week, some shrubs have gone in at that parking lot, and when Councilor Price called me about this, I inquired through the planning department and got a copy of the landscape plan, which was approved for it. So what is there now, our planning department, what is there now is just the first step. And I'd called Eric Thorson, who is the CEO of Columbia Memorial, and Eric was able to get back to me this afternoon to say that the additional plants that are supposed to be going in around that parking lot are on back order. And so once the additional plant materials come in, the rest of the parking area will be fleshed out with additional plants. But Councilor Price and I talked about, you know, maybe the base standard and with regards to the size of container plants and caliper size of trees, whenever new landscaping plans.
That would be great. I think many of us will remember when Michelle Reeves did the her assessment of downtown Astoria three or four years ago. And one of the things that was clearly noticed by her was sort of the lack of trees in the city, particularly, and the kind of rough hardscape entrances on the east and west end of town. So whenever we have an opportunity to do that, I hope we can take it. Otherwise, does the mayor wish to take public comment? There's a request.
There's somebody back there waving. Yes, Chris.
Chris Ferrar, 3023 Harrison Avenue, Astoria. Sorry, but I walk by that place all the time, and it's kind of weird what they did at the east end of that parking lot. I can't quite figure out what those people are supposed to do that live to the east of it. But what I really wanted to comment on is the vegetation, and tonight it's probably going to go below freezing, and tomorrow night it's supposed to be down to 28, I think. And I walked by there this morning, and all those little plants that they planted, little 2-gallon plants or something in there, there's about this much of them, of the root ball, sticking totally out of the soil. And it's going to freeze tonight or tomorrow night, and all those plants are going to die unless somebody mulches another 2 to 3 inches of soil around that whole thing they just did. They're exposed, the roots, the white roots.
One of the things also that we want to make sure of is that as we look at any landscape plans, that we also are making sure that there's adequate visibility from street rights away for there's a term called SEPTED, community policing through environmental design, SEPTED. And that's something just to make sure that while we're doing it, that we're making sure that shrubs don't get too high, that you can't see it, that they provide the visual barriers, but also provide the visibility into sites so that people feel secure as they're getting in and out of parking lots. So that's all to be factored in through the whole process. But I think I saw our community development director jotting down a note as you were mentioning that, Councillor. So.
On a positive note, I would like to say that I am so glad to see that facility gone from that corner. And I think that the city has worked very hard to put this whole thing together with the hospital. And I think in the end, it will be a much improved visual than we have had in the past. And I would like to thank the city for their efforts in putting this together with the hospital.
Sure, and so I move that we approve 6F.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. Okay, regular agenda items. Our first one is the Heritage Square Environmental Protection Agency grant.
So the city was awarded a $400,000 Environmental Protection Agency grant in 2012 for assessment and cleanup of the Heritage Square site. And that work has been going on over the past few years, and there's been discussion and with regards to some required contract amendments that were necessary last fiscal year with regards to this project as some of the remediation took place. And at your May 2016 meeting, the council authorized a contract amendment with our consultant, AMAC Foster Wheeler, for $37,000 for additional site cleanup work and for installation of a groundwater monitoring well. And these were required as a part of the Department of Environmental Quality standards to be able to clean up this site. It was anticipated that contract amendment would cover the remaining scope of work and the additional Department of Environmental Quality oversight time. However, that was not the case. And a further contract amendment was needed. The amendment, which is before you this evening, does not include any additional tasks which were required by the Department of Environmental Quality, but there was more time needed by the consultant team and the Department of Environmental Quality to complete the work. The contract amendment before you tonight is for the consultant work by AMAC Foster Wheeler, an amount not to exceed $18,100. There is additional Department of Environmental Quality oversight fees, which will be required in an amount of approximately $6,000. There's a separate action which is on your Astoria Development Commission meeting agenda tonight to be able to fund both of those items. I would note that the total revised contract, including this current contract amendment and additional Department of Environmental Quality oversight fees, would be a total amount of $587,334. Of this total, $400,000 has been funded by the EPA grant, and $82,000 has been provided by a Business Oregon grant, which resulted in a total urban renewal contribution of $105,334. $40,000 of that was a required match of the grant. I would note that when this property was acquired by the city knew that there was contamination on the site. We have been able to secure Department of Environmental Quality grants over the years to be able to do assessment, and we were lucky to be able to receive this $400,000 federal grant to be able to help us take on this task. It was known that when the city purchased this property that we would have to do this work. This is something that we were going to have to do before there'd be any sort of redevelopment. I would say that, you know, that, you know, with this, you know, the, I look at this as, you know, that we've had the fortuitous circumstances where Business Oregon has provided us with additional funds in the amount of $82,000, but this additional work is needed to be able to get us further. Jeff Harrington is here tonight to talk a little bit more about the next steps, and I'll maybe just give a little bit of a summary, and if there are any questions, you can ask Jeff. Where we're at right now is that we are needing to continue to have monitoring of the monitoring wells which were installed, to see whether or not there's any migration of any groundwater contamination off-site, and that needs to be done to satisfy DEQ requirements. Also, the Department of Environmental Quality is stating that regardless of what happens there, whether or not it has a park, a parking lot, a library, a housing, whatever it may be, I'm saying that, and there's been all these different ideas, regardless of what goes there, there's going to have to be some sort of cap, which is going to be installed on the eastern side of the site where the elevated parking lot is. And again, I'll remind everyone that the parking lot on the east side of the site is hollow underneath. It looks like it's a solid surface, but it is hollow underneath. And what is most likely going to happen is before a letter of no further action is issued by the Department of Environmental Quality, that cap is going to have to be installed. So there, what we're anticipating is that there will be, I'm going to call it a condition of approval, putting it into Community Development Department terms, that assuming the monitoring well results come out positive, they will issue some sort of tentative sign-off with this condition of approval, and we'll then, as a city, determine specifically how we're going to move forward with the redevelopment of the Heritage Square site in the future. So, Jeff, I don't know if you want to add anything else or just answer questions.
I can just add, I went back through some of the reports that were produced, and I just had a couple notes here that are noteworthy. Out of the studies, they ended up finding out there was four main categories of contaminants. So total petroleum hydrocarbons, which are referred to as TPHs, polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, which you hear as PAHs, you'll see that term on the news every once in a while, and the polychlorinated biphenyls, which is PCBs, and then some heavy metals. So all that material, the real good news is all that material was removed. They removed 97 tons of hazardous material that went to Arlington and about 1,500 cubic yards of non-hazardous soil material out of there. And that's quite a bit of material. So when they had all that out, what they had to do, and the reason for some of the extra work, is come through and do what they call closure sampling. And they sampled 225 samples of that entire area. And that's where they came up with some of the samples having some residual contaminants. It's the same type of stuff, but much smaller doses. Not hazardous, but they just want to avoid human contact with it. So that's the reason for the cap. And we're not proposing that we go spend money now to cap it. The capping they're proposing to come from the development. So it's something that you're going to do anyways, whether it's a concrete slab under a building or we demo that structure and fill it for the park or whatever the for that original layout that showed the sunken
amphitheater,
which would require that structure to probably be removed or altered at least. So in the big picture of things, this work that needs to be done, the well and the modeling that they do for groundwater and to determine, verify that no contaminants have made their way or are going to make their way to the Columbia River, is all good things to put behind us and know that that's not happening and just to conclude that we've done a good job cleaning it up and that if say, for example, a contaminant's discovered on the next street, they can look back and say it's not from this site. So we're really kind of wrapping this up tight, and that's what DEQ's kind of migrated into. They, as they learn more about the site, more about the contaminants, more about the project, they just have done extra work wanting to really wrap this up tight and seal it up for good. Any questions?
Any questions for Jeff? My only comment is it just seems like we keep getting more and more and more amendments.
Yeah.
And more and more and more fees. And, I hope that there's an end to this and that eventually this area will really be clean. I thought when we took everything out that would be the end of it and that we would get a no further action. I think we should throw a party when we get that no further action letter finally.
And Mayor, I think that the hope was is that after we removed all of those soils out from under the site that it would the post removal testing would come out 100%, where there would be no concerns. The thing is as Jeff had stated, while the contamination was removed, there still was enough residual there that the Department of Environmental Quality is coming back and saying, to meet standards, there's additional work and additional, ultimately, cap that's going to have to be installed to be able to meet those levels. Would be able to remove all of it, and then that would be one thing. One of the things that we were challenged with over on that eastern parking lot is we had to be able to remove the soils while at the same time keeping the footings that are supporting that parking deck in place. One of the other alternatives would have been to demo that entire parking deck and take away all the parking downtown. Maybe we could have gotten the letter of no further action there, but I think that some of the downtown merchants may have had a different perception if we would have done that. So it's that we were trying to figure out a way to be able to continue to utilize that parking deck while removing the contamination materials.
I know you can't predict this, but do you think that this payment that we're making right now might be enough to get that no further action letter?
I certainly hope so. One of the things that I was mentioning to the city manager earlier was if, you know, AMAC, the consultant doing this work, is really, believe me, they're really trying hard to be as efficient as possible. And in what's happening is, you know, basically DEQ, this is, you know, we have this grant, a pilot project, and things are a little different, the requirements, all the documentation that's required to satisfy the grant. So I think, I don't want to say it's new for them, but it's probably, the pilot project is new for everybody. So they're kind of working through some unknowns. And in the DEQ, you know, they're helping us. I can't beat them up like I can a consultant on their time and their fees because they're helping us here and they're doing a great job too. But I just think their forecasting of the effort that it was going to take for them was short. And to no fault of theirs, they're, like I said, kind of moving through new territory here.
But Mayor, I think the bigger question is, and as I was stating earlier, because we do not have a final established redevelopment plan for that site, we won't be getting the letter of no further action until such time some sort of development occurs over there. And development could be, again, whatever we choose there, and then that's going to be when the cap is installed. The proposal, which is before you today, is to be able to get us to the point where we can then get all the DEQ analysis completed, and then things will be on pause. Things will be on pause until the city determines what is going to happen there. And Jeff, I mean, if I'm understanding correctly, that once we then move forward with a redevelopment of the site, the DEQ will be then again re-engaged when the cap is installed. So there most likely will be some costs, some review costs from DEQ once the development occurs. But we're trying to get to the point where we can then hit pause.
Yeah, if you look at the scope of work included in the memo, there's two items that are future items, and one is the protective cap. And the second one is what they call an easement and equitable servitude document, and that's basically the deed restrictions. The only deed restriction that they've mentioned to us so far that's 100% is that you cannot put a groundwater monitoring well there. Well, we have a drinking water well. We have drinking water, a potable water supply in the city, so it's not like anybody's going to need to put a well there for drinking water. So that will have no impact on us. It's not a site that you'd want irrigation water or anything like that from a well. The cost to develop a well just won't be cost effective with our water supply in town. But those two items are tied to what the development is. So once the development goes in, depending on what it is, that's when they can determine deed restrictions. And if there are to be any other ones, they're just tied to the activity that's going to take place there.
Okay.
Mayor, can I ask a few questions?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Harrington. Mr. Estes, if I'm hearing you correctly, in order to satisfy one of the requirements of the grant to clean up the site, it will be at the expense of the city to cap the contaminated property, correct? In order to receive a letter of no further action.
So there's you mentioned the grant and then also the letter of no further action. So we're going to be ultimately closing out the EPA grant in advance of getting a letter of no further action, because we will have satisfied all of the requirements of the federal grant to do all of the assessment and the remediation, you know, to a certain point. And then the federal grant will be closed.
But we're being required to cap the site.
By the Department of Environmental Quality, which is a state agency. So
do we know, like, about how much that's going to cost?
It depends on what sort of development. Okay. I mean, so if we, I'll tell you, if you're looking at constructing a building, if you're constructing a building, putting a concrete basement floor could serve as the cap.
Mm-hmm.
If you are looking at filling that site and using it as a park or a parking lot, the fill material that would be put in there could serve as the cap.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, it's something that, depending on the development scenario, things that would be constructed as a part of a regular development project may be a de facto cap.
Okay, so one cap does not fit all developments. And also, I think you did a good job kind of summarizing how we got here. But I just wanted to make sure that we were clear on the history of the site. The city, when it purchased the property from Safeway, realized that the site was contaminated, much like many other properties in Astoria. But I don't think that the city knew that it was going to necessarily have to do cleanup, especially to this level. I mean, we could have done no cleanup or a smaller amount of cleanup and done certain types of developments, but we've done the most stringent type of cleanup, the type of cleanup where it's so clean you could build housing there. So we've got a lot of different options in terms of what we can do at the site, whereas if we hadn't... You're looking at me kind of weird.
Yeah, I'm
going to
disagree.
Okay.
So when the city purchased the property,
okay,
we knew that we were going to have to remove the contaminated materials. There were agreements that were signed between the city and Department of Environmental Quality acknowledging the levels of contamination that were there and that there would have to be remediation done for the site. There was a determination done when we started the cleanup through this EPA grant,
mm-hmm,
as to whether or not we were going to clean up to a residential standard or not.
Mm-hmm.
And the determination was, let's move forward with cleaning and with the end goal of cleaning it up to a residential standard.
Mm-hmm.
And we were talking about this earlier today as staff, and while the while we did work with DEQ to clean it up to residential standards,
mm-hmm,
we did not take out materials above and beyond what we did just to meet that residential standard. Maybe there's more time and effort that's been spent by the Department of Environmental Quality to review and assess that.
Mm-hmm.
But we would have, the end goal was to do it to a, I'm gonna call it a park standard,
mm-hmm,
we still would have removed the same level of materials.
Hmm. Okay, thank you. But it is to a residential standard.
Right.
Thank
that,
you.
That was when we did it to a residential standard because at the time when we started, there was starting to be some discussion about the potential of residential development there. And we didn't want to have a scenario where we cleaned up a site, the council determined that they wanted residential development there, and then had to go do yet another project.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's such an interesting convoluted history of that site. I think at that time when that decision was made, while there may have been talk of residential, maybe that wasn't the current plan. So we have cleaned it up to residential standards.
Right.
So it's an option.
That's where we're, yeah, that's where we headed as,
mm-hmm,
when we started this EPA, yep, grant project.
Thank you. And thank you to whoever turned off their car alarm.
So just following up on her question, though, so it is the responsibility of the city to cap that site?
It'll either be the city if we're developing it, or if you had a partnership with a private developer on something, it could be part of their project. A good example might be like the Mill Pond, where there was requirements, much more stringent requirements for the developer. And just through the process of filling the area, bringing it to grade, making it ADA compliant, all the slopes and everything, those capping requirements were met.
By the developer?
Yeah.
Okay, great. Any other questions, comments? Thank you very much. Then we need to execute a contract amendment with Amick Foster Wheeler in a total not to exceed $18,100 for additional site cleanup work and groundwater monitoring for the Heritage Square EPA grant cleanup project.
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
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 Opposed? Thank you. Item 7B is a resolution amending the fee schedule for Public Works Department.
So the Public Works Department manages city infrastructure, including streets, water, sanitary sewer, and storm drainage systems. And there are city codes which utilizes permits and applications and application fees to manage these improvements and maintenance work by homeowners, commercial businesses, developers, and franchise utility providers. The fees associated with these applications have not been updated since 2005. The department is proposing a fee update which has several goals, and one is to simplify the current public works fee schedule, which does away with outdated items. It increases fees to cover the cost to review and process applications and permits. It strategically reduces fees for some items, which are maintenance items, such as sidewalk repairs that local citizens may take on, and updates the fee structure to allow third-party costs, such as whenever there are county filing fees or geotechnical reviews, to be passed on to the applicant whenever that's applicable. Fees which are associated with development review and public works department inspection are not included in this time, as staff plans to work with the community development department to bring forward a comprehensive fee update associated with development review and building permits in early 2017. Tonight it's recommended that council adopt the resolution amending the fee schedule for the public works department as presented.
I have a request. Could we have some kind of a three-hole punched thing where we can just add new fees as they come in, as we approve them? Because...
You probably want to look at the city attorney and ask this question.
Okay. We get asked, I think, as council members all the time about the fees. And for the most part, we don't know what the fees are. So it would be really helpful to have one thing that had all the fees in it. And I understand why we can't have all the fees done at once, because Public Works may need fees raised at a certain time, parks may need fees raised at another time, the police department may need fees raised at another time. But if it was a three-hole punch thing where we could just insert the new fees, that would be extremely helpful in answering questions of constituents.
But I think maybe the confusion is that every time all the fees are included in one resolution, and so when you revise the fee resolution, you'll see in the packet there's a list that says what the current fees are versus what the proposed fees are. Look in your council packet. Right,
yeah, I know.
And then there's the whole fee resolution, which is behind it, which is the readoption of the entire fee resolution for the city. And so, I mean, Blair, are we able to, when we readopt the fees for departments, is the question that you're concerned because all the fees for the entire city are brought forward at the same time, or what's the...
No, just that... No, it isn't that at all. I wish they were all brought together at the same time. The problem is that each department brings their own resolution, and they want to raise their fees in each department. If we pass that, then we could slip that in, and then we know what the current fees are. Rather, this is the current fee, but if we pass this tonight, the proposed fees, then that will be the current fees.
That's correct. And so,
am I not making sense?
I just want to know what the current fees are for each of these departments so that when I talk to a constituent, I'm not saying something incorrect.
Well, I would hope that if you don't, you would contact staff, and if, I mean, it would, if a constituent asks what the fees are, that you would contact staff so that we can provide the.
But why can't we know that?
Well, you can. You can, but I mean, so the fee resolution, which is included in your packet, has all the different departments' fees in it. And if you look at the resolution, which is included in your packet, it has every one of the various departments' fee schedules.
I see that, but I still don't understand why we can't three hole punch this, and when we have changes, we could take out the old and put in the new.
You could do that, but having the, what we would do is we would go off what is the last resolution which was adopted. So there'll be a resolution date which was adopted, and so to verify and make sure that you had the latest one, if you were to contact Julie and say, what is the latest fee resolution, she would pull the last city council meeting date and provide that to you.
I believe all these fees are on the city's website.
They are also on the website. And we could send you that one if that would be helpful. So as soon as it's a new one's adopted, we upload the new fee schedule for all the fees on our website.
Okay.
Does that bother anybody else or no?
Apparently not. Okay.
I saw a lot of heads agree with you when you asked, am I not making sense? I think a lot of people did think you were making sense. So
I just want to make sure that that can be done, but I want to make sure that I'll tell you that whenever you start mixing and matching pages, having the latest adopted resolution is what we would go off of. Because once this is signed, there will be a resolution date of December 5th, 2016, and that will be if this is approved tonight, then that will be the latest version of adopted fees. And so, and then if there was a change next month, the current fee resolution would have a new date of January, whatever, 2017.
Okay, well, if it wouldn't be too much trouble, I would like to suggest that the new resolution in total be sent to the city council, just so we can...
A paper copy.
So we have that in case people call us and ask about fees.
Okay. We can definitely do that. If you're saying you would like to have that once it's adopted?
Yes.
Okay. We can do that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay.
Can you wrap it up and put it in a bow, like a Christmas
that's
package?
Right. That's right. By golly. Okay. So where are we on this? Okay. So anybody else have any comments or anybody on the council?
Yeah, I just, these fees will be good to have because there are some serious changes, and I'm sure they're well overdue, and probably you compromised in some cases more than you want to. But I suspect there'll be some screaming in the streets around January 8th, once a developer figures out what they're going to have to pay versus what they would have paid on January 5th. So everybody get your developments in line now.
Yep. So it is recommended that the council adopt the resolution amending the fee schedule for the Public Works Department. Could we have a motion to that effect?
So moved.
Second.
All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
Thank you very much. Okay. Any business from the public?
We have the additional item.
Oh, yes. We have an additional item. Okay. So we have an item about the Aquatic Center.
And the proposal here is moving into the new year and the holiday season, our Parks Department staff has proposed that as a way to try and get new individuals to sign up for yearly passes or sign up for the automatic withdrawals for the rec center and aquatic center passes, that there be an incentive that they get 1 month's service for free. And that would be if they purchase that between December 15th, 2016 and January 15th, 2017, then this would be a incentive to be able to sign up. And our Parks Department staff feels that this would not only provide benefits of active living, but would also generate new customers and increase the department's revenue.
Ms. Cosby, is this only for new patrons?
Yes, and we have in the resolution and in the medal as a customer who hasn't held a monthly pass within the last 6 months. So maybe if you hadn't been visiting or weren't a current customer.
Okay.
How would this be promoted? Mm-hmm. And do you have any estimates on how much this might cost and what kind of return we might see? Or is it just kind of an experiment and we've got to try it and see what kind of response we're going to get?
I knew you were going to ask that question. Marketing person. It's an experiment. We don't have the personnel to have that type of business mind or those type of numbers prepared. So it's a test. We won't be adding really much additional cost. All the services are continually being provided. The classes, it will be until maximum capacity as it currently is. So our goal is to create the best experience possible so hopefully we can gain some new customers and keep them coming.
Mm-hmm. I think it's okay to do tests. I don't think there's any way that you would know what kind of outcome you would have from this, but do you have any measures in place with the new POS system? Is there any way to track whether or not this is successful? Mm-hmm. Well, I realize your department is really constrained right now, but is there any talk or any forward momentum at all with implementing a marketing plan, which is part of the park's master plan? I mean, in an ideal world, this would be part of a marketing plan. We would have goals, objectives, measurable results, and it'd all be part of one big cohesive campaign. Okay. Well, I think it's a good idea. I think it's a good test.
Any other comments, or could we have a motion to approve the resolution to allow the parks and recreation sales promotion?
So moved.
Second.
Okay, we need a roll call on this. How about Ms. Cosby?
Councilor
Aye.
Councilor Ward?
Aye.
Councilor Price?
Aye.
Mayor Lanier?
Aye. And my error, we need to go back to the item B because that was also a resolution and needs a roll call vote. So this is amending the fee schedule for Public Works Department. We did have a motion and a second, so we'll have a roll call on item B. Mr. Cronin.
Councilor Nemeloy.
Aye.
Councilor Price.
Aye.
Councilor Ward.
Aye.
Mayor Lemire.
Aye. Okay, and I think Dulcie Taylor has somebody to introduce tonight.
I'm going to look. Dulcie Taylor, 1287 Commercial. I am wearing my ADHDA hat tonight. And I would, as you know, we lost Elena a couple months ago, and I've been doing her tasks, and I'm so happy to come to you tonight and introduce you to Sarah Lou Heath, who is our new executive director for the Downtown Association.
Welcome.
You can come up here.
Thank you.
Sarah comes to us from Restore Oregon in Portland for the last 3 years, I believe.
Year and a half.
She's been in Portland for 3 years and originally is from Austin, Texas. Do you want to say a little something about how glad you're to be here?
I'm Sarah Lou Heath. I live at 854 Glasgow, or Glasgow, Astoria. So I'm happy to say I am new here and I have found housing. Thank you for your concern. I'm excited to be with the ADHDA. It's an amazing community of a great downtown and a wonderful working city. So thank you all.
Welcome.
Okay, welcome. We're glad to have you.
Thank you.
Okay, any other business from the community? Okay, you're on.
My name is Fred Bone, and I live at 824 35th Street. I bought my house here about 20 years ago, and it was configured into a duplex. I decided to take the kitchen out upstairs, or two kitchens, and convert it back to a single-family residence. When I pulled up the linoleum in the upstairs kitchen, the floor was covered with newspapers. And the date on the newspapers was 1943. And I was looking up, I was so intrigued. I was looking up and reading them instead of doing my work. And a studio apartment was $20. Has it gone up any?
Yeah.
A one bedroom was $25 a month. But this town expanded its capacity for the soldiers and sailors who fought that war, and we won. Younger people may not remember. And then the town grew up, the soldiers and sailors went home, and that was the houses got converted back into single family dwellings. I converted mine back. But now the housing situation is again tight. The rents are going up fast. There's 500 new Coast Guard postings. And that's why I support the ADU alternate dwelling unit ordinance. I understand it's been put over until February.
It hasn't been set yet. We don't have a date set.
Exact date, but I do support it. I think it's a great idea, and I don't think it should be for bed and breakfast or any foreign visitors for short-term rentals, but for long-term rentals, absolutely, it is absolutely needed.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank
Appreciate
you.
Appreciate it. Anyone else? Okay.
I'm Deborah Hazlett. I live at 91906 Lewis and Clark Road, Astoria. Today I'm here just to introduce myself. I'm the executive director of Butterflies Forever, and we're a local nonprofit that is trying to put together a permanent butterfly exhibit. We had a temporary one in Seaside a few years back. And we're looking for property here in Astoria. And one of our pieces that we're looking at is owned by the city. So I'm just kind of introducing myself and letting you know that we're trying to get this really rolling again. We're a 20-year-old organization. We have our complete business plan on our internet website. And I just wanted to pretty much just introduce myself and let you know we're out there. And the other thing is that coming up this weekend, we have a Gifts That Make a Difference group that's getting together at the Liberty. And I hope everybody will come and support all the different nonprofits that will be there from noon to 4. Thank you.
Can I ask you where this property is or what property is?
Well, we haven't narrowed it down specifically, but what we would like is to look at the property east of the Maritime Museum, east of the railroad. There's about 2 acres there. That would be about a minimum for us because we want a lot of parking for buses as well as motorhomes during the summer. And we're talking about an over $2 million building project. So it's a substantial investment that we're looking at. Okay.
Thank you. Uh-huh. Anyone else? Okay, I will close then our meeting and we will move into the Astoria Development Commission, and you will be surprised because it will be the same faces up here.
Do I gavel or do I not?
Yeah, you can do. Yeah.
I will gavel.